Father, we look to you now for your leading in this hour. We have great need again for your guidance, that you would be truly our teacher through the work of your Spirit as the Lord Jesus promised to us. And as we look again into some of the lives, the failures, the successes, the joys, the sorrows of these people in the awful days of the judges, I pray that you'll give us a real compassion for those around us who are in the same circumstances with the same need, and who can have an even greater sense of forgiveness, a greater sense of victory in life than the people did back there due to their limited knowledge. And so help us, Lord, to learn that we may be used of you to minister to others in need. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Now today we come to the study of Ruth, one of the most intriguing little books in the Bible, in my estimation. You will find, incidentally, some good detail on the book of Ruth in this book by Leon Wood that I've mentioned. It's in your bibliography, Distressing Days of the Judges. I would commend this for your purchase, Distressing Days of the Judges. I'm sure you'll want to teach and preach on the judges if you want a lot of useful background material and exegetical material. It's in this, and you wouldn't know it otherwise from the title, but the book of Ruth is also in here, because she lived, apparently, according to Leon Wood, apparently she lived during the time of Gideon. He has certain reasons to deduce that. Turn with me, please, to the book of Ruth, and I'll just move through it very quickly, and then I want to come back, spend most of the time with some basic principles and perspectives on this book. It would be very easy to take a lot of time in the narrative. It's so exciting, it's so down-to-earth, it's so personal. You can just really feel with these people what they were going through. If you kind of keep your map in front of you there, you'll notice where Bethlehem is. This is the first time that Bethlehem really comes into prominence. Bethlehem has been there for a while. It's just a small sheep-herding town. Bethlehem is going to become very important later on, because it will be in this city, of course, that David lived as the youngest of eight brothers, the sons of Jesse, and Samuel is going to come to the town of Bethlehem, and he's going to anoint David as the first king of Israel from the line of Judah, the man after God's own heart. But this is our introduction to the town of Bethlehem. And of course, it hardly needs to be mentioned that this is where Jesus Christ would be born later on. So as you think of the Christmas story and the incarnation and Jesus being born in Bethlehem, let's remember the first time that we meet this town of Bethlehem, that we visit there, was in the days of the judges with the story of Ruth. Ruth was living in the land of Moab, and it doesn't show too clearly on your judges map, but it's below the Arnon River. And so presumably when Naomi and her family, Elimelech and the rest and the two sons left Bethlehem because of the drought, they probably would go down south past the spring of En-Gedi, past what it later became Masada, around the south end of the sea, and it was very shallow there. They might have walked across. Sometimes they forded across some of that lower area. It would be very salty, of course, very hot and humid, 1,300 feet below sea level, and then they'd move around onto the into the area of Moab, just south of the Arnon River. And that's what we have happening in chapter 1. In the days that the judges ruled, there was a famine. Famine in Scripture very frequently is used by God to bring people back from idolatry. You can just about associate famine with idolatry. The clearest evidence of this is in 1 Kings chapter 16, chapter 17, when Ahab was in a time of famine for 3.5 years when Elijah was challenging him on his idolatry. But we don't know that that's why famine came, but it's quite likely. And they moved down to Moab to live there, this man and his wife and his two sons. And while they're down there, they married two girls, two Moabite girls, and the father dies and the sons die. Now this is an unusual situation. She goes out with a husband and two sons, and while she's over there, all three men in the family die. Now that's bad enough in our culture, but it was devastating in an Oriental culture, because they had no welfare, they had no aid to dependent children, they had none of the advantages that we have to take care of a situation like this. And they were over there for 10 years, as we see in verse 4. And then the word comes that the rains have reappeared, that the crops are good, and that there's food again back in Bethlehem. I'm sure you realize that the word Bethlehem means literally house of bread, bait, is house of, in a more general sense, house of, place of, sometimes family of, and Lechem is bread, Bethlehem. And so this is house of bread. And the day comes when Naomi has made a decision to go back. And she says goodbye to these two girls, and she expects to leave them there. And she said, I can't do anything more for you. You have no reason to come back. And they said, oh, we'll go with you. We want to go back with you. And she said, no. She says, if I were to have a husband tonight and sons were to be born, why, it wouldn't be, it would be 20, 25 years before I could give you any more sons. There's nothing that I can do for you, nothing I can give to you. And they both went with her to the border, probably to at some point along it in the Arabah, that area at the lower end of the Dead Sea, the south end of the Dead Sea. And they got to the border, and she tried to persuade them to go back, and Orpha, the one sister, did go back. But Ruth, amazingly, went with her. Why did she go with her? And I want us to understand that she did not go with her because of the hope of having a husband, but she went with her because she had been converted to worship the God of Israel. Her decision was based on a spiritual experience. Of course, we have no firsthand knowledge of it, but apparently Orpha had not had this experience. And I think there's a real spiritual lesson here that what we are spiritually, our relationship with God, will determine our other decisions. This was a very simple geographical decision. Either you stayed in Moab, either you stayed in Moab or you went to Bethlehem. Now that doesn't mean that Orpha couldn't have been converted to the worship of God. I'm not saying she wasn't, but I'm just saying that in the visual aid before us, one girl stays with the god Chemosh, where he was worshipped. The other one went to where the god of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was worshipped. And she said, your God will be my God. Now, of all the things that she said, that was the most important. You know the story in verse 16. She says, where you go, I'll go. Place. Where you stay, I'll stay. House. Your people will be my people. People. And your God will be my God. And it was that last one that was the climax. That was what determined her going. She went for only one reason. That was the place where God was worshipped. And so they went on to Bethlehem. The entrance into Bethlehem was something less than spectacular. No ticker tape parade. It was a Kleenex parade. They moved in there and there was weeping. There was bitterness. Can you imagine Ruth's emotions as she comes back? Or she comes rather not back, but for the first time into this new culture, this new people, what did she expect? What had she heard about them? What had she seen of them in terms of her own family that she had married into? Naomi is coming back 10 years later in bitterness. And all her peers, the ones that she went to school with and the ones that were at her wedding and her bridesmaid, her matron of honor, and all of her family and the sisters and all the people around. They said, here comes Naomi. Naomi's back. Hey, spread the word. Here comes Naomi. And she said, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. She says, the Lord's dealt bitterly with me. I want you to notice the difference. As she walks in sour, embittered, blaming God, mean of temperament, she comes into Bethlehem. She's hardly going to be the person that goes around in the social circles and gets invited to all the coffee times and so on. She's a negative character. But before God is finished with her, she's the happiest middle-aged lady in all of Bethlehem. God's going to do something. You can imagine Ruth in all of this. She's somewhat mystified. The more I read of the events that took place in these four chapters, recording these four chapters, The more I tried to put myself into Ruth's somewhat smaller sandals, the more I see that Ruth is one of the most outstanding women in the Old Testament. When you consider the circumstances into which she came, the circumstances in which she found herself, her background, her upbringing, her culture, what she found when she came there, who she was, or rather who she wasn't, because she was nothing. She was a Moabite coming into this land. And the fact that the woman she came with and who was her only security, so to speak, Naomi, wasn't exactly the most happy traveling companion and really had a very negative attitude. What did she have going for her? Virtually nothing. But none of it seemed to bother her. If you ever get discouraged by your circumstances and the people around you that you got to work with, remember Ruth with Naomi. Naomi probably complained about the salt in the air and what it did to her hair and the dampness and the humidity on the way and how dusty it was and there wasn't enough water and hoped that there'd be something there when she got there and all the rest of it, you know. So whenever you get in that circumstance, remember Ruth. Ruth just, none of it seemed to bother. She seemed to be impervious. She just seemed to move on. I find that kind of person uncomfortable to be around, but it's nice to have them. They kind of convict me, but at least not only do they convict me, but they, I think, encourage me. Well, I get there, and they move into some place to live, and they've got to live. It's the time of the barley harvest. It's March, April. They're just reaping in the fields, and she doesn't know the local culture, but Naomi introduces her to the local culture. She says, now, we've got a custom here, Ruth. Ruth said, what are we going to eat? How are we going to get food? You know, we don't have any, haven't planted anything, and we don't have any income. She said, we've got a good custom here, and that is that when they have the harvest time, that anyone can go around and pick up what the harvesters leave. They can go around and glean. So, Ruth, why don't you go out and do that? Ruth said, I'll do that. That's fine. You know, Ruth could have said, well, wait a minute now. I'm not one of your people. You got me here. You look after me. Not at all. She was willing to do it. She had a servant heart. And she, you know the story, she goes out and she gleans, and she happens to come across, as Calvin would say, she just happened to come to this particular field. And she starts to glean there, and the owner of the field is into Bethlehem, probably checking on the arrival of some of his equipment or the sale of the barley or whatever. And he comes back, and can you believe it that there's an eligible bachelor in that area? Who would ever believe it? A bachelor, a wealthy bachelor in at that time was almost unheard of. I mean, they were just like diamonds in the sand. And so in verse 8, he finds out who she, verse 7 rather, he says, who is, verse 6, I'm sorry, verse 5, I'll go back there, sorry, verse 5, whose damsel is this? Where'd she come from? Who is this girl? He knew everybody there, so here was a new one. And I think that Ruth was probably worth looking at. You see, she would be, if she had been married for several years, she'd probably be about maybe even 28, 35, something like this. And he noticed her. And it was unusual to have a woman of that age gleaning in the fields. Because normally she would have a husband, she would be doing this kind of thing. And especially a woman with the obvious, if I may put it this way, class of Ruth out in the fields gleaning. And so she caught his attention. And he did six things for her. Not all at once, but they happened within hours, it appears. In verse 8, he says, listen, he says, don't go and glean in any other field. Stay in my field. And then in verse 9, he says, listen, he says, I told my young men that they shall not touch thee. They're not supposed to flirt with you. Don't flirt with that girl that's gleaning. And he says, beside that, you can drink of what the young men have drawn. In other words, you don't have to get water for yourself. And that was quite a concession because, you know, the women drew the water for the men. And he says, you can have what they've drawn. And then in verse 14, the fourth thing, he says, listen, come and have lunch with us. I'm not so sure the menu was all that great with morsel and dip thy morsel in the vinegar. But maybe that was the salad bar they had there, I guess. I don't know. And verse 15, they had parched corn, which is, you know, the precursor of Fritos and that sort of thing. And then in verse 15, said, let her glean even among the sheaves. This is the fifth thing he does. He says, she doesn't have to go around and pick up what you've left, but he says, even when you've collected it into piles, let her go in and take all she wants out of the piles of it, so she doesn't have to spend all her time going around the edge picking up the remains. And she's furthermore, he says, not only can she pick that up, but he says, you leave someone on purpose for her. Just sort of when she's coming along, just drop it off the wagon and just kind of let it fall at her feet. Now he's making it just as nice for her as he possibly can. And she doesn't jump at all this. She's impressed by it. Notice how she sees herself, her view of herself. In verse 10, she says, why have I found grace in thine eyes? I'm a stranger. She didn't think the world owed her a living. She said, why have I found grace in thine eyes, seeing as I'm a stranger? Now, I'll tell you, that is really our approach to God, our approach to the Lord Jesus Christ. Why should he extend grace to me, since I'm a stranger? Stranger in the sense that I have no rights in the covenant of Abraham. Good cross-reference on this is Ephesians chapter 2. We were aliens from God, without Christ in the world, aliens, strangers to the covenant of promise. Long in about verses 10 to 12 of Ephesians 2. But you'll notice in verse 12, he says, I've heard all about you. And in verse 12, the Lord recompense thy work, and a full reward be given thee of the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings thou art come to trust. The thing that most impressed Boaz was her spiritual quality. Not her humility or her physical appearance, which we can assume to be quite acceptable. But what impressed him was the fact that she had come to trust under the wings of Jehovah, the Lord. Now remember that. Just remember that verse, because we're going to pick it up later and something that happens. Well, they developed this association, and all of this apparently happens in a day, because in verse 20, when she comes home, well, in verse 19, she comes home, and Naomi says, well, where were you today? Oh, she says, I was gleaning down the field there. What was his name? Boaz. Boaz. Uh-huh. Boaz, you say? She says, blessed be the Lord that have not left off his kindness. Naomi's starting to warm up a bit. She's starting to sweeten up that bitter spring in her heart. And then Ruth just happens to remember something else. Just, you know, throws it out there as a postscript in verse 21. Oh, listen, he also said that I was to do thus and so on. I could stay there all the time and so on. Ruth and Naomi on verse 22 says, ha-ha, it's good, my daughter. You just stay there. Hang in there. And verse 23, she kept by the maidens of Boaz to glean until the end of the barley harvest and of the wheat harvest. Now, the barley harvest, you remember, starts about the time of Passover? You remember the first fruits? And it goes through until about what time? Feast of Pentecost, down into June. So we got about a two-month period in there that, from the start of the barley harvest to the climax of the wheat harvest. And in chapter 3, Naomi says, well, we better take action in this. Now remember that it was not Ruth's initiative that got her married. It was Naomi. And in that culture, marriages were normally arranged by the parents of the participants. But of course, this was out of the question with Ruth, because her parents were back in Moab, and she was now, as it were, under the authority or under the protection of Naomi. So it's for Naomi to take the initiative. And Ruth is quite naive, quite uninformed about the local customs, about the kinsman redeemer, about the relationship of Boaz to them, and what she would have to do and he would have to do and all the rest of it. So Naomi fills her in. She says, here's what you do now. She says, in a situation like this, the next move is up to you. Next move is up to me? Yeah. What'll I do? Well, I'll tell you what you do. I know from what's happened here, Naomi can say. And by the way, it wasn't just what Ruth had told her. I'm sure that she had full information about everything that was going on. And although it's not in the text, it is very, very likely that since Boaz was a relative, a kinsman of Naomi, and this was going to take place, it's very likely that Naomi and Boaz had consultation on this. And so as a result of all of this, Naomi says, now here's what you do. She says, you take a shower, put on that best perfume you've got, and you go on out there in the evening, and you are going to do the thing that has to be done, namely, tell him that you're willing for him to marry you. Because in this situation, he had, in effect, to use our local term, proposed. He had made himself available, but in order for the thing to proceed, she had to respond. And the response in this kind of situation was to be done in a symbolic way, as we'll see. And so she went out to the threshing floor, which would once again be kind of on a little ridge. They would thresh in the evening because the convection currents would bring up the breeze from the west blowing toward the east. And they would be on this threshing floor, and in the evening, 5 o'clock, six o'clock in the afternoon, they would throw the grain up into the air, and the chaff would be blown over into the valley, sort of, or at least off a little bit, and the grain would be left. And they would do this in the evening, and they would stay out there. No point in going home after dark, because they would work until dark, and they'd stay out there, and so he slept. So he slept by himself, being the owner of the thing. He didn't sleep with all of the hired help, but he slept more or less by himself. And he had eaten well and drunk well, and he was quite sleepy, and after all that outdoor activity and heavy meal in the end of the day, and outdoors, he goes to sleep. And she comes in, and she uncovers his feet. That could mean that that could be a way that she knew that when it got cold, he'd wake up with cold feet later on in the night. We don't know that for sure, but she uncovered his feet and laid down. Well, he's asleep, and she's watching him, and the man woke up. His feet are cold. Wakes up, he turns around. He's afraid. What's going on? There's something strange here. Somebody's here. And he sees this woman at his feet. And he says, "Who are you?" Incidentally, I'll say this respectfully, that the very way that he responded shows what a man of high moral character he was. The way she did, of course, as well. He was a man of outstanding character. She says, "I'm Ruth, your handmaid. Spread therefore thy skirt over thy handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman." Ezekiel 16:8 is a good cross-reference on this. Ezekiel 16:8, we find another occurrence of this expression. "And the spread out the skirt over" was a euphemism, a symbolic act, which means to take under the protection of, or in this situation, to marry. You remember I mentioned back in verse 12 of chapter 2 that you should remember under whose wings thou art come to trust? Well, the symbolism is parallel, that as Israel, as a nation, came under the wings of Jehovah to trust him for his protection, his authority. Notice, authority, protection, and provision are the key words. Under authority, under protection, and provision. So Israel was called the wife of Jehovah. And we find this expressed in Ezekiel 16:8, and we find it here. So to spread out the skirt was another way of saying, was the euphemistic way of saying, "I am willing to come under your authority, under your protection, and for you to provide for me as husband." And he understood what it meant. She said, "For thou art a near kinsman." Now, how did she know he was a near kinsman? Because Naomi had told her. And near kinsmen in Moab probably didn't work quite the same way in their culture and their customs as it did here. But this was a special arrangement. I just stop on that for a moment. The near kinsmen concept centered around the value of the land, the importance of land. Land was not bought and sold in Israel as we do it today. For instance, today you can go and look at some real estate. You can say, "I want that." They'll search the deed, the title to the deed, make sure it's clear. You pay X number of dollars. They give you the land. It's yours forever, and that's it. You can do with what you like. There are no holds barred. You just trade it around like money almost. Move around. But in that day, you did not alienate land from the family, from the tribe. You remember the tribal areas? The land had to stay in the tribe. For instance, somebody in Ephraim couldn't go up and say to somebody in Naphtali, "Hey, I got a couple acres down there in Ephraim I'd like to sell to you. How much is it?" "Well, come on down and look at it. Hey, that's great stuff. I'll buy it." So a guy up in Naphtali owned some property down in Ephraim. It didn't happen that way. You can understand that. Keep the tribal areas. Now, the tribes were made up of families. So what was true of the tribes was also true of the families. So the families kept the land within their area. But when the head of a family would die, then the land would, in a sense, go up for sale but not to be sold to somebody who would take it into somebody else's family, because the widow, in many cases, couldn't carry on. She didn't have, she couldn't farm it and use it. And so the thing that would happen then is that a near kinsman would buy it, near kinsman, to keep it in the family. And the only problem was here that when the head of a family died and did not leave any heirs, then the near kinsman who bought the property or took the property over, paid for it, took it over, and he had to be within the family, he had to become the father of children for that widow. That's called levirate marriage, or the brother marriage. And the reason for that was is to keep that line alive so it wouldn't die out when that father had died out. Now that's the background of all of this. And so what had happened is that Elimelech's property was there. Naomi could not handle it. She had no hope of any other sons. She had now brought back the daughter-in-law. And so if this, to deal with this land situation, a kinsman redeemer had to do two things. He had to buy the land and he had to marry Ruth. And that's what this is all about. So there's land involved in this whole thing. Well, you can read the rest of the chapter in which he says, I'll do the work of the near kinsman for you. Now, you just stay there for tonight. It's dark. You're not going to go back in the middle of the night. Some people say, why did she stay all night? Well, what do you want to do? Send her out in the days of the judges, knowing what violence there was, and send her back into town? No, she's under better protection with him. And the morning, he sends her back, and he's so excited about this and wants to tell Naomi, send a message to Naomi. He says, listen, give me that apron. Put up that apron you got, this big cloth. And so she puts it up, and he dumps in what the authorities tell us is about 80 pounds of grain. And it says he puts it on her head, ties it up and puts it on her head. I'm sure she was impressed. In fact, she'd probably get compressed. He made an impression on her, she prayed. But he puts this load on her head, and she goes back in at 6:30 in the morning with this load of 80 pounds of grain on her head. And Naomi says, how did it come out? She says, guess how it came out. She says, it's all set. So now, after not much sleep, I doubt if Boaz slept the rest of the night. Boaz goes back into town. First thing, he's got to get this cleared up. So he gets into the gate, which is like the town square, the courthouse square in a county seat. He goes into the gate of Bethlehem, waits till the people all gather around in the morning. That's the place where they had court cases and made judgments and deals and decisions and politicking and so on. And he waits until this near kinsman comes along, because he's got a problem. There's one who has a prior right on the land and on Ruth than he does, basically on the land. So he can't bypass that one. Notice how careful he is here. And he waits till that person comes in. We don't know what his name is. Some people have suggested his name is such a one, because he says, ho, such a one. But anyway, he calls him on. He says, come on over here. What you want, Boaz? Well, I want to talk with you about something. All right, sit down. We're all going to sit down. It gets 10 men. I point you, and you. We got 10 witnesses. All right, sit down. Now listen to this case. What's going to happen? He said, Ruth has come over from Moab, and she needs to be married. And, we've got some land here. Sorry, he starts with the land. He starts with the land. He says, there's some land here, as you know, that belongs to Elimelech. We need to take care of that now. Naomi can't handle it. She doesn't have any heirs. And so we're both, we're kinsmen. And so we've got to redeem that land, buy it back. How about it? Do you want it? And the old such a one says, yes, I'd like to buy that. I could use some more land. Good idea. How much is it? He said, well, now just a minute. He said, I want to tell you one other thing. That if you buy that, you've got to take Ruth with you. Ruth? Who's Ruth? Well, she's that girl that came over from Moab. And he does some fast calculation. And I think it's Leon Wood that suggests that if he married, to buy the land is one thing. He could use the land, no strings attached. He's in the family. But if he married Ruth and they had children, then those children would be heirs to the land. And in some way, they might even come in and be heirs to some of his own land. And that's what he means when he says it would spoil my inheritance. In other words, it would mess up the whole land deal. He said, the land's okay, but, you know, Ruth, I don't want to get into this because if there are heirs, it would be complicated. He says, no, as a matter of fact, thanks anyway, but I decline. And for the first time in 10 minutes, Boaz breathes. He's been just waiting for this answer. He says, you don't want it? You're like, no, he says, I don't want it. You sure? You sure? Okay, you had your opportunity. You had your opportunity. All the witnesses, you see, I've done this legally, right? You had the opportunity. What did he say? He said, no, all right. I'm going to buy the land and I'm going to marry Ruth. All right. And so he takes off the shoe, gives him the shoe. They traded shoes. They had this shoe covenant and so on. And they make this covenant. Well, I mean, sandals, you know, it's not exactly like, you know, 8AAA or something. But they traded shoes and they made it. This would be equivalent to going into the courthouse and notarizing the property deal and the whole thing. And then, of course, they get married. And there's great joy. And in verse 14, Ruth has had a son. And the women say to Naomi, blessed be the Lord which hath not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And the women come around and they name him, his name is Obed. Notice in verse 17, the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, a little baby a name, and they said his name's going to be Obed. Can you imagine how that grandmother held that little baby? And they didn't know the half of it. They didn't know that Obed was going to have a son, and his name was going to be Jesse, and that Jesse was going to have 8 sons, and the youngest of them was David. And David was to be the great king of Israel. So things did change for her. Now I'd like to suggest a few things just by way of perspective in the time we have left on this. The story itself is intriguing enough. Ruth came from Moab. And if I can picture it back into her situation, I would suspect that from the time she was a little girl, she had been told about a great horde of 2.5 million people that had tromped through her land. Right? Children of Israel, when they came on up there. And it wasn't all that long before that, because this was probably about 1100 B.C., so we're only talking about 200 years before that. And there weren't all that many exciting things happened in 200 years that they would forget this one. And she probably heard about Balaam and Balak and this great horde of people. She might have heard about Rahab at Jericho. She might have heard all of these things, and she had heard great things about this people of Israel. And yet, in this situation, when she was over there in Moab, she was in a very difficult scene. She had lost her husband, and probably because she had married an Israelite, it wouldn't be all that easy to marry a Moabite person. Because the Moabite young men might say, listen, we weren't good enough for you in the first place. Why should we marry you now? I don't know. But if you were in Moab with these 3 widows, would you hand them the 4 spiritual laws and say, God has a wonderful plan for your life? Would you have enough faith to say that? I don't know if I'd have enough courage to say that. If you said to Ruth, Ruth, if you could have anything you wanted, what would you want? Oh, it's too much to ask for. What would you like? Well, I guess the 2 things I'd really like is to have a husband and to have a son. Because remember, there are no children born to these marriages before the husbands die. I like a husband and a son. I think we can arrange that. Now, Omar, what would you like? I'd like to be a grandmother. Because Naomi probably was very worried about the fact that she would never be a grandmother. And how can a woman of 45, 50, 55 years of age live in the company of all her other people, of all her peers, who have grandchildren? It's done, but it would be difficult, especially if you were bitter about the whole thing. And so they move on in faith into what God has for them. She was an alien. She was an alien. Ruth was an alien from the people of God, from the promises of God. She's an alien from the God of Israel. She had everything going against her. The people of Moab worshipped Chemosh, C-H-E-M-O-S-H, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites. And just in case you think she came from a proud nation and she could take some courage at that, remember that her nation started in incest when Lot had relations with his eldest daughter, and the son born was Moab. So you didn't exactly look back to 1776 and say, we have a proud heritage. What I'm trying to picture here is that as far as Ruth was concerned, she was from a nation that had a very unusual and negative, shall we say, start. She was brought up to worship the god Chemosh. She was a widow at a relatively early age, and she had no children. Now, that's about as low a picture as you can get socially and nationally and religiously. Furthermore, Israel wasn't all in all that great a condition. The days of the judges. Let me just mention four or five words that will key us in now, although you're quite familiar with the days of the judges. It's a time of apostasy. It wasn't exactly a time when there were religious revivals going on that any place you went you could find a tent meeting and get saved. It was a time of apostasy, worshiping Baal and Ashtaroth. There's a time of servitude and fear. They're cringing around, not knowing who's going to sweep down on them next. There was a time of immorality. It's a time of rebellion against God, a time of violence, a time of rebellion against God. By the way, their broken relationship with God broke their relationships with each other. That's why it was a time of violence. People are violent with other people, I think, to the extent that they do not have a relationship with God. And by the way, if I may just hitchhike on that for a minute, the deadly factor is that if you do not believe in a God who created you, then you have no basis for thinking of yourself as having any significance or importance at all. And you have no basis for thinking anybody else has any importance or significance. And so the result of that logically is, I have no respect for myself, and I have no respect for anybody else. And the outcome is violence. The opposite is true. To the extent that I know God, I have respect for myself, because no matter how low I am, no matter how difficult my circumstances, no matter how discouraged I may get, no matter how I may fail at things, I always have the truth that God created me and He loves me and He gave His Son for me. And secondly, I'll have respect for other people, because what's true of me is also true of them. Interpersonal relationships depend on the vertical relationship. I think one of our problems today in modern psychology, in secular psychology, I'll say, and sociology, is trying to solve the horizontal without the vertical. And you can see it in the days of the judges. And yet, in this situation, I want you to mark this, that Ruth was to glisten like a diamond in black mud. Just think of the days of the judges as gooey, black mud, is symbolic of everything that's dirty and filthy and mean and violent and nasty. And imagine coming along to a plot of ground like that and finding a diamond reflecting the sun. What would you think? You'd think, what's this diamond doing here? And I believe that one reason God gave us the book of Ruth is to relieve the tension of the book of Judges, to show us that His grace is sufficient, even in the darkness. And she was to shine as a light in the midst of a wicked and perverse generation, just what Paul told the Philippians. You are to shine as light, Philippians 2, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. And that's what she did. And yet, you say, well, why would she worship the God of Israel? She had every reason not to worship Him. And this is the miracle of how God brought her to Himself. Because, listen, there was famine in Bethlehem, and you didn't go to worship a God that let His people die in famine. She had lost three husbands, all Israelites, and anybody could say, hey, it's bad luck to be related to the Israelites. You lose your husbands. There was nothing in her marital relationships that would excite her about how wonderful Israel was or their God was. And all she had to do was hear the stories coming out of Israel. You read those last four or five chapters of the book of Judges and see whether that would draw you into a relationship with their kind of God. If she went to Bethlehem, she would have less hope of marriage, even less hope of marriage. She'd be an alien with no rights, and she'd have to leave her own mother and father and people and culture. All I'm trying to show is that there was something very strong that came through to her. And the strong thing was that she believed in the God of Israel. She believed that God was there. That even if His people failed, and even if her circumstances were bad, even if her experiences were bitter, there was a God in Israel, and the only important thing in her life was to go and to worship Him and to be with His people. I'd suggest several characteristics of Ruth. First of all, she was perceptive. I think these are things that men and women can well emulate. She was perceptive. She was perceptive about God and His people. She didn't say, well, there's too many hypocrites in Israel, I don't want to believe in their God. She was perceptive enough to realize that even though God was holy, all of His people weren't necessarily holy, but there were Gideons and there were people that He touched, and that people are frail, but there were some people that were responding supernaturally. She could see beyond the immediate problems, and she could see beyond the physical dimensions to the spiritual. Second, she related well to people. She related very well to the people that she joined as she came over there. All of her personal relationships seemed to be good. Third, she had the capacity to love people and make commitments to them. That's so important. She had the capacity to love people and make commitments to them. Naomi and Boaz. She was not self-centered. She never asked, what can I get for myself? She was really saying, what can I do for Naomi? She had a sense of responsibility. She had a sense of responsibility and of servanthood, willing to go and pick up what was left in those fields. I'd like to state just in 1 minute four principles. I'll just give them to you. One, God loves aliens, ordinary people, when they turn to Him. God accepts aliens, and we're all born aliens to Him. God accepts aliens, and she's an example of it. Ruth the Moabitess, who eventually came into the line of the Lord Jesus Christ Himself. Secondly, it's possible to live for God in spite of culture and peer pressure. Second, it's possible to live for God in spite of culture and peer pressure. Third, it's possible to live for God in spite of culture and peer pressure. Okay? Third, God can bring beauty from ashes. God can bring beauty from ashes. He can turn things around. God can bring beauty from ashes. You don't have to write this down, but Naomi, we start with a famine and a funeral, and we end up with a family. Grandson. And fourth, God has a wonderful plan for your life, for their life, for every person. Even widows and old bachelor farmers. I want you to read and reread and meditate on the book of Ruth. You'll get a lot out of it. We go on to 1 Samuel tomorrow. All right. As God began to make Israel a nation, He raised up Moses to deliver them out of Egypt. They were never a nation before that. All they were was a family of 70 people, an extended nomadic family that went down to Egypt. After several hundred years in Egypt, Moses was raised up, and he was the deliverer that led them out. And then as they got to the land of promise, where they were to have a land for their nation, and as they had a constitution and a religion and an organization and structure and so on, they were ready to enter the land. Moses died. And then Joshua led them into the land. And so Joshua was the cohesive factor in that generation, leading them into the land. As they got into the land, it was God's purpose that they would worship Him as God, and the fact that He was not visible should not have been a factor at all, any more than it should be a factor at any time in history. As we pointed out then, we have no visible leader today. And it's still true as it was then, that God is spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. Hebrews 11:6. So this is the basic concept that we're seeing behind all of this. After Joshua died, we entered the period of some 300 years of what is called the period of the judges. And the people's problem then was that they could not worship or would not worship a God whom they could not see. They had a national cohesive force in their worship of one God. But keep this in mind as a grid for all of this period. the period of the judges and on down after that, that if they worship God, if they had the right vertical relationship, they had a nation. They had a national identity. They had a national unity. They had a national strength. They had a national consciousness. There was a cohesive force, and it was in worshiping one God. But the opposite was also true. Because when they stopped worshiping one God and began to go after Baal and Ashtaroth and all the gods of the land, it was like cutting the nervous system of a body. It was like cutting something in the spine or the back of the neck. All of the parts then were all independent and not cohesive. And so there was a fragmentation, there was a falling apart. And as we read several times in Judges, everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. There was no king in Israel. The problem was not that there was no king as a visible person. The problem was that they had left the one cohesive factor and force of worshiping of a common God. So their idolatry not only alienated them spiritually from God, but their idolatry was the cause of their weakness as a nation, and I should really say, was the cause of the fact that they were not in fact a nation. They were only 12 tribes. You get the point. There was a fragmentation all over the place. Now, they perceived that the answer to this was the kind of answer that other nations had, namely one visible person called a king. But their problem was not that they didn't have a visible leader. Their problem was that they were fragmented because they did not have the cohesive force of worshiping one God. That's the basic factor behind all of this. So toward the end of the period of the judges, the last of the judges was a man named Samuel. And as we get into the text of 1 Samuel, we see that his birth was predicted. He had a very special kind of a family life and relationship and mother and potential and so on. He was the brightest star that had come on the horizon for hundreds of years. He was really a man of God. I was saying in another class that none of the judges that we have listed that led the people to deliverance, none of them was really a spiritual giant. They were used of God, but their weaknesses were more glaring than the quality of their character. But Samuel was another person. Samuel was really a great spiritual leader. Incidentally, he had one great failing, and inexplicably, his one great weakness was the same great weakness that his predecessor had. He neither could not or would not control his sons. It's just unbelievable that he would let history repeat itself. You've read the story, and I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but it is significant in this whole stream of events that Eli's sons were his downfall, and Samuel's sons were his greatest weakness at the end of his career. As a matter of fact, it was the character of his sons that really precipitated the pressure, the final pressure for the monarchy. But that's getting ahead of the story. Samuel then was used of God to anoint the first king, namely Saul of the tribe of Benjamin. And when he showed himself to be a rebel, and keep in mind that Saul was a personification of the ethos of the people. Saul was a personification of the ethos of the religion, if you please, of the attitudes of the people. Saul was not submissive to God. He was self-willed. The people were self-willed. When he evidenced this rebellion in a very distinct way in chapter 15, which just about splits the book of 1 Samuel in two, God rejected him. And the watershed in the book of 1 Samuel is really chapter 15, when Saul finally refuses to obey in killing the Amalekites. And at that point, God, through Samuel, says, "You will not be king any longer. I will raise up a man after my own heart." Now, Saul went on reigning right to the end of the book. But Saul was taken from his place of primacy. In other words, his dynasty, his family would not continue. He was taken from the place of real kingship, even though he continued to rule. And then in chapter 16, David is anointed, and for the rest of the book, David is the anointed king who is chased unmercifully by the king that's on the throne. And in the last half of the book, from 1 Samuel 16 to 31, we have nothing but constant conflict between Saul and David. Saul dies in the last chapter of the book. I'm just giving this is a helicopter view. Or the blimp, you know, looking down on Yankee Stadium or whatever. We're just seeing these people like ants out here at second base or whatever. But the last half of the book is where Saul chases David around, and the last chapter of the book, Saul dies. That brings David to the throne, and all of 2 Samuel is the reign of David. I think it would be helpful at this point if we not only surveyed the events, but if we surveyed the notes. The top of page 7, and here you see the stream of action in 1 and 2 Samuel. You see the boxes there at the top? All right. For the first 12 chapters of 1 Samuel, we still are in the period of the judges. We have two judges, Eli, the old man, who is replaced by the boy Samuel. And then Samuel grows up and he becomes the one in authority. In other words, he becomes the one authority figure in Israel. Then in chapters actually up to chapter 12, in the last chapters there, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, we have the process by which the monarchy is established and Saul is on the throne. So Saul is finally put on the throne officially in chapter 12. So that beginning with chapter 12, we have the monarchy, and obviously the monarchy goes right on down through history until the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC as the method of government, as the organizational structure. So that's the end of the judges and the beginning of the monarchy with chapter 12 of 1 Samuel. Now the first king, of course, is Saul, as you see, and his reign is recorded in chapters 12 to 31. He dies in 31. We have David's reign all the way through 2 Samuel, up into 2 Samuel about chapter 2 or so, up into 1 Kings chapter 2. There David dies and his son Solomon takes over, which is a later story. Now notice the dotted line. The dotted lines refer to David's career. And so David's career from 1 Samuel 16 to 31 can be characterized as a preparation. This is when he's being chased around. This is when his character is being developed. This is when people are coming to him as a leader. This is when it's very evident that he has the gift of leadership. And this is when he's out there depending on God. And at this point, you have many of the Psalms written where he speaks of his enemies coming after him. And, oh, God, deliver me, and I'm helpless. I'm like a little sheep, and so on. These are great days for David. And then when he takes the throne at Saul's death, and notice carefully that David never does the slightest thing to get rid of Saul and replace him with himself. Never. It's all God's initiative. He doesn't take the slightest initiative. As a matter of fact, he has lots of opportunities and he never uses them. But when he comes to the throne at the beginning of 2 Samuel, he has triumphs. After some hassling with the family of Saul, as they set up a separate kingdom up in Gilead, finally that crumbles and he is king of all Israel, all the 12 tribes. He takes the city of Jerusalem for the first time and makes his capital there. He establishes all kinds of administrative structure. He is the great leader, the great King David, and everything is triumph until you get to chapter 11. In chapters 11 and 12, you have a sin with Bathsheba. And after that, everything is tragedy. His family, there's murder in his family. There is, incest, rape, murder in his family. Finally, his son that he loves, Absalom, rebels against him. And David himself has to flee up to Mahanaim. And there's a fight in the woods. And finally, he gets his throne back. Nothing goes right for David after that. The only thing that really goes right for him after the middle of 2 Samuel is the final big event of his life, public event, and that is when he buys the threshing floor of Araunah on the east side of the city of Jerusalem, and that becomes the place where the great temple will be built by Solomon. And this is kind of a nice lift at the end of his life, but that's all. So I want you to be very clear so that you could just, I could call you up at 2 o'clock, don't you call me, but I could... Don't call me, I'll call you. 2 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, what's in 1 and 2 Samuel? And you could just wake up and say, well, you know, 1 to 12, and 12 to 16, 16 on, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, now back to page 3. Back to page 3 of these. I just want to tell you what the maps are. Some of them are not as significant as others, but I thought you might like to have them. And you may wonder why I do so much with maps and places and dates and so on. I want us to know that the events here are pinned down in time and space. And in the first place, I get a lot more joy and benefit from being able to picture these people right where they were, whether they went 20 miles or 200 miles or 5 miles or 50 miles. It makes a lot of difference. And what time of day it was, if we know that, and what kind of terrain was like, and what the people were like, and so on. It just makes it more real, rather than just seeing names in the page that don't mean anything. If you don't own any stock in the stock market, and that ticker tape goes by, all of those numbers are just jumbled to you and absolutely of no interest whatsoever. But if you own certain of that stock in there and they go by, every number will mean something to you. And you can hardly wait till it comes on the screen. Well, I hope that you can hardly wait till this comes on the screen because of your understanding of the backgrounds of where these things took place. You'll notice the scale of miles in these various maps. Always notice that because that gives you a sense of proportion. Some are large scale, some are small scale. Okay, the first one on that page is Saul searching for his asses. You've read the story on this. You know where it fits in. He starts at Gibeah, and he looks all over the place, and eventually they come back to Ramah, where Samuel was, and there he is anointed king, and eventually he goes back to find his asses. That is not a terribly important map, but at least you can see that it took place. And the second one below it, Saul delivers Jabesh-Gilead. This is in chapter 11. By the way, the chapters where these occur in the bottom right, are in the bottom right-hand corner of the page. And that's kind of interesting because, as we'll see in chapter 11, he starts at Gibeah where he lived and went on up and collected people throughout the country and delivered the men of Jabesh-Gilead, and they never forgot it. And that's when they saw him as a leader. And then the Battle of Michmash is when Jonathan is prominent in 1 Samuel 14, and this began actually the downfall of Saul. While I'm on the map there, I might mention that you'll see the square where it says Geba. That was the Israelite camp, and the square up about an inch and a half from it is the Philistine camp. The first action is when Jonathan goes over, and he takes this little garrison of 20 men, and then he chases the Philistines back up to their camp, and they get afraid at this. They think that the whole army is after them, and there really wasn't, and they run back, that three in a box, that's the third phase, and they run back to Philistia. So what really happened is that Saul didn't win anything, but Jonathan scared the wits out of them by having the nerve with his armor bearer to go up and kill 20 of them. And so it's sort of a domino effect, and the dominoes got bigger as you went. That's not a terribly important map either, but at least you can see where it took place. All right. On the next page, on the other side of that page, Saul's reign. This is important because I want you to have in your mind the establishment of the kingdom, that the background of why it was established. I've mentioned some of that just a few minutes ago. Here it is in print. Israel sought a king, as we will see, because of the evil conduct of Samuel's sons. That precipitated it, but it wasn't the real cause. There was the threat from surrounding nations, especially the Philistines. They said, Lord, they're hassling us. And you remember, all through the period of the judges, these nations have been after them. There was no great empire. There were no Assyrians. There were no Babylonians. There were no Persians. There were no Greeks. There were no Egyptians. There were no big empires. But there were strong nations around them that kept pounding on them. And the third thing was the envy of surrounding nations who depended on a visible leader, not an invisible God. It was awfully embarrassing to go fight the Philistines, and they had Dagon, and they said, well, Dagon's with us, and there's Dagon over there in that box, and where's your God? And we don't have one. Eventually, it kind of got so embarrassed that they took the box with them. And lost it. That was the ark. Talking about putting God in a box. That was the mentality of it. That's their background. That's where they're coming from. But the real problem was the issue. The issue was Israel's unwillingness to pay the spiritual price for God's protection and provision. They had no military. They had no agricultural. They had no economic. They had no domestic problems.
no meteorological problems, if you please, with the rain and so on, whatsoever when they obeyed God. Life was uncomplicated. Life was simple. Life was straightforward. Everything. It was a land of milk and honey, and nobody could touch it, just as if it had a 20-foot wall around it. But they didn't want to pay the price. The price for that protection and provision was that they had worshipped one God. And every time they went up on the hillside and offered a chicken or whatever it was to one of those sticks up there, the wall broke down, so to speak. And it didn't rain, and the enemy came in, and they had these hassles and so on, every time they intermarried. So this was the big issue. We're going to see that Saul was installed in four stages. First, there was the private anointing at Ramah. That's when he lost the donkeys. Went after the donkeys and came back with a crown, you might say. And then there was the public choice by Lot and Mizpah. This was to involve the people in the process. And then in order to demonstrate his ability as a leader, in order to galvanize them into following him, God made an arrangement whereby he turned out to be a hero in rescuing the people of Jabesh-Gilead. It was a very high-profile thing. Everybody knew what was going on. It was a showdown, confrontation. It was all the marbles, one way or the other. And Saul, may it be said to his credit, was a very brave man, indignant at injustice, and he went up and he beat up on the Ammonites who were threatening the men of Jabesh-Gilead, and he was a hero, and they said, he's our king, that's great, we've got a good leader. And it encouraged Saul, too, because in the situation before that, he'd been hiding amongst the stuff, as it says there, and this encouraged him, too. And finally, there was the official formal recognition and coronation at Gilgal, at which time quite a speech was made by Samuel on the whole matter of the monarchy. So there were four stages of installing him as king. The significance of his reign, the biggest problem, the biggest issue facing Saul when he came to the throne was the fragmentation of the nation. More than anything else, they needed national identity. Can you imagine a nation today having any kind of national identity if, A, they didn't have a capital? Do you know of any country in the world that doesn't have a capital? And B, it didn't have one recognized leader of all the parts of the place? I just can't imagine it. And that was their problem. They had no capital. They had no central government. Now, it may be like South Africa that has three capitals for different regions, legislative and judicial and so on, but no capital. Samuel was in the center of the country, as you can see on the map. He had a small circuit. There's only probably a circuit of 25 miles altogether around. So it wasn't widespread. That underlined the fact that they did not have a central government that really involved a lot of the people. But thirdly, and this was very significant, he was a spiritual leader. He was an authority figure who was a spiritual leader. And so he was the last of the judges, but we have to really recognize that he was a little bit different than all the other judges. Because he was a spiritual leader, he was a recognized spiritual leader. He was more of a prophet than he was a judge. Keep that in mind. He was basically a prophet in the sense that he was a voice from God. I don't perceive Gideon as a prophet. I don't perceive Samson as a prophet. Now, it's true that Deborah was a prophetess. But in the sense of being an authority figure over a period of time, Samuel really was different. So let's keep that in mind when we think of him. He's just a small circuit there, a circuit riding in the sense that he sat in judgment in three places, but they're all fairly close together. So the big thing they needed then was unification. So the significance of Saul's reign, he produced at least a partial unification of the tribes. That really means, translated, that when he fought the Philistines, he had support from most of the tribes to fight them. In other words, it wasn't just the tribe of Benjamin fighting them, or just the tribe of Dan, as in Samson's case, but he did gain the support of most of the tribes. And by the way, one way he did that, one of the main ways he did that, was this excursion up to Jabesh-Gilead when he got everybody behind him in indignation. I hope you read chapter 11, because this won't make any sense otherwise. That's a real hero chapter. He protected Israel's borders. In other words, not just his tribal borders, but he tended to have a concern for all of Israel's borders. He maintained a simple court. Probably didn't know how to do anything else. But he never did have a capital. He never did have a palace. As far as we know, he just ruled off the patio at the back of his house, because it's always referred to as Gibeah of Saul. It's a little town about 6 or 7 miles, about 4 or 5 miles north of Jerusalem. And it's always Gibeah of Saul. He just came back to the ranch or back to the villa or whatever it was, and he just ruled from there, the Paternelles of Israel. And then he blazed a trail for the monarchy. Well, what that means is that there was never a situation in which they could say, well, the other king never did it this way. He was the first king, so everything he did was the first time. And if he did this, well, that's what the king does. If he did that, that's what the king does. But they never had a king before in Israel. So he blazed a trail for the monarchy. But he was replaced by David because of his self-will and disobedience. So the significance of his reign are really in the first four, but they end up in that last one. Now, the next page we will get to when we get to chapter 16. Just remember that for 1 Samuel 16, because that is an appraisal of the world into which David came to be anointed. That was David's world as he entered it. Turn on, please, to the next page, page 6. Got good news for you. You don't have to learn all the places in that map. Got bad news for you. I don't know which ones you have to know. No, seriously, I'll give you a list of the places you need to know for the next exam. How's that? But I wanted you to see, have one map in which you could at least in one place have all the places that are mentioned in 1 and 2 Samuel. Then on page 7, Saul's kingdom, I think it's helpful to realize that just as in the days of Judges, he did not possess all of Palestine. The Philistines were very strong along the coast, the Sidonians up in the north, the Arameans, their capital was Damascus, and the Ammonites constantly pressing from the east, the Moabites, the Amalekites, and Edom, and so on. So he really controlled that. You'll notice that within his country, that the area around Bethshan was not controlled, and Jebus, Jerusalem, you notice the dot around that? He never did take that. He lived in Gibeah, just north of there. Okay, the next page. I guess that's all we really need to take, except over on page 9. Sorry, page 9. I obviously had to put these where they would fit on pages so they're not always in sequence. But the top of page 9, Saul's basic problem. Tie that in with the life of Saul. God was no longer his God. Saul had replaced him, taking control of his life. And here are some of the characteristics in his life that evidence this. Insecurity. He was one of the most insecure people in all the Bible. He was insecure with people because he was insecure with God. And he was insecure with God because he was insubordinate with God. And it's just as simple as that, and profound and devastating. Jealousy. Because he wasn't sure of himself and where he stood with God, because he didn't have that inner security and peace, he was jealous of other people. Instability. He changed his mind. He did dumb things. Instability. You couldn't count on him for always coming through with the right thing in the right situation. You can imagine how devastating this was to people who had never had a king before and thought that the king would solve all their problems, and the king does rather stupid things. One of the dumbest things he did, just a little thing, if you've read 1 Samuel 14, you know that Saul was very worried about these Philistines, and he got uptight. And he said, all right, I'll tell you what we'll do. Nobody's going to eat until we beat the Philistines. Nobody's going to have a bite to eat until we eat the Philistines. He thought that would do it. Talk about pressure, you know. These guys think, boy, we're going to die of starvation. We better get out there and fight. That was real drafting. That was real pressure on him. And then, as I mentioned the story, not knowing that, his son Jonathan goes out with his armor bearer, knocks off 20 of them. The 20 get scared. The others get scared, run away. The whole army runs away, and the Philistines have all gone. And old Jonathan's, you know, had a hot day, and he comes across some honey and dips his hand in the honey and eats some honey. The armor bearer eats it, and they go licking their chops back in. And Saul says, I perceive that somebody's eaten during the day and broken my command. They said, he shall die. And they said, what's your son Jonathan? He shall die. And he's about to put Jonathan to death for eating a handful of honey after he gets tired chasing the Philistines away because of this dumb thing that Saul had laid on them. I mean, making people hungry doesn't motivate them to fight necessarily, except with each other. And the people say, Saul, what are you doing? You're not going to kill Jonathan. He delivered us. Don't be stupid. Saul says, okay, I won't kill him. Now, what kind of a leader image does that produce? See, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, instability. Fear. By the way, he was unstable with David. All the time he's chasing David around, he found David is going to kill him, you know. And on two occasions, David stops dead in his track, turns around and calls to him from another hillside, hey, Saul, here I am. What are you chasing me for? I haven't done anything for it, do you? Oh, David, I'm sorry. Thou hast said right. That's wrong. I'll never kill you. I'm sorry. This is very foolish of me to do this. Hours later, he's chasing him again, you know. Loss of perspective. I guess that covers a lot. He lost perspective on his son. He lost perspective on David. And he lost perspective on himself, his family and everything, and murder plans. You can just see a whole pattern of character here, of when you're not right with God, everything goes wrong. And it went from bad to worse. The results, of course, disobedience to God, broken personal relationships, that's an understatement. Nearly broke them with a javelin. National defeat, they kept losing battles. And finally, commit suicide on Mount Gilboa. So, I hope that those are helpful to you in tracing through the life of Saul. Virtually all the rest of the materials in your notes, in your supplementary materials, have to do with David. All right, now let's go back to and walk through 1 Samuel as far as we can get this morning with that background in mind. We're going to see that for the first 8 chapters, Samuel is prominent. And then there's a transition where Samuel hands over authority to Saul, which is really chapters 8 to 12. Samuel is still in control. But after this overlap or transition between 8 and 12, then Saul takes charge in chapter 12 and Samuel fades out of the picture. We only see Samuel once or twice. As a matter of fact, the last ministry that Samuel has is in chapter 15 when he tells Saul that he won't see him anymore, that God has rejected him. Then Samuel dies in chapter 25. All right, in 1 Samuel chapter 1, we begin with the background of Samuel. If ever there was a wanted child, it was Samuel. Wanted in the worst way. Because there was a man in Mount Ephraim. Does that say anything to you geographically? Where was Mount Ephraim? Right in the middle of the country. Incidentally, they call it Mount Ephraim. There was no literal Mount Ephraim, but what it means is the mountainous area of the tribe of Ephraim. It was the hill country. They speak of the hill country of Judea and Mount Ephraim. But what it's really saying is that it's in the mountains of the region of Ephraim. So just north of Jerusalem, in that area of Ephraim, which was very strong, you remember, it's going to become a leader of the northern tribes eventually, there was this man who had two wives. If you want to discuss polygamy and two wives, and if you would like an additional wife and find some scriptural support for it, then, you know, maybe discuss that in another class. But obviously, I can't get into the polygamy thing right here, if you don't mind. Let's just take it as it is. He had problems. The one wife, Peninnah, had children, and the other wife didn't. Can you imagine the domestic pressure in that situation? And he loved Hannah in verse 5. And look at verse 6. Her adversary, who do you suppose that was? Well, Satan ultimately, but apparently Satan used Peninnah in this thing. Her adversary provoked her sore for to make her fret. And if you've never had that kind of experience, you're going to have it. Somebody's going to provoke you sore to make you fret. And whoever it is, or whatever it is, it's Satan behind it. He's just pushing the buttons, and you're seeing the result. And as he did so, year by year, this adversary, when she went up to the house of the Lord, she provoked her. Therefore, she wept and did not eat. So every year, she goes up to the house of the Lord. Now, the house of the Lord at that time was at Shiloh. And Shiloh was about 10 or 12 miles north of Jerusalem, not far from Bethel. And this is where the ark was, more or less halfway between Gilgal and Shechem. This is where they put the ark, sort of in the center of the whole area. It just geographically right in the middle, I guess. And when they want to worship God, they went up. They didn't go to church every Saturday or Sunday or whatever, but they they did go up periodically to bow before the Lord and make sacrifice. And they went up there, and as they did, Eli the priest was there. And in verse 10, she was in bitterness of soul, and she wept sore. She only had one thing on her agenda, and that was she didn't have any children. Now, if her husband didn't have another wife that had children, there might have been some doubt maybe it was the husband's fault, although husbands never got blamed for it until recent years when they could prove that maybe it was the husband's fault. But all through history, the husbands have never been blamed for childlessness. But of course, with the other wife with children, this compounded her problem. And finally, she makes a vow. She says, "Lord, if you'll give me a son, you can have him. Just let me have a son for you." Now, even though her circumstances were unusual, I wonder if this isn't the prayer that could well be prayed today. How many married couples would pray, "Lord, give us a daughter, give us a son for you, that we could have that child and raise that child and be entrusted with that child so that we could produce a person that you could use to bring many people to Jesus Christ." What a way to start off. What an attitude. And it would follow through the upbringing of that child. Anyway, that's what she did. She says, "I'll give him to the Lord all the days of his life. No razor will come on his head. He'll be a Nazarite. He'll be special." The idea here is he'll be set aside as a Nazarite, specially for the Lord. And she's praying here earnestly. And of course, here you see the degradation of the priesthood. When the priest sees her praying, he says, "What's the matter, woman? You drunk?" Talk about judging other people by yourself. Whenever he saw a woman moving her lips and no sound coming out, he assumed she was drunk. It never occurred to him she might be praying. What kind of theology was that? Anyway, Samuel is born. They call him Samuel, and it's very interesting that Samuel means, "I have asked of the Lord." And the verb to ask is sha'el. Sha'el is the verb to ask. Incidentally, it's a Hebrew verb from which we get the word sheol. Sha'ol? Sha'ol means the place that they ask about. In other words, the unknown place, the mysterious place, sheol, as we call it. And it comes from the same verb. And Saul comes from the same verb as well. He was the king who was asked for. Samuel was the son who was asked for. I don't want to belabor it too much, but it's interesting that the difference between Samuel and Saul is that the two letters L at the end of Samuel's name, which mean God. And so in a sense, Samuel was the one they asked God for. Saul was the one they just asked for. I don't go out and start a new sect on that or denomination, but I really think it's interesting to notice the wording here. All right. And she said to her husband, "You go on up and worship now. I'll come up later, because when I come up, I'm going to leave him. I promised him the Lord." And so for 3 years, she kept it at home. He was weaned. And finally, she takes him up and brings the child to Eli, verse 25. Beautiful statement in verses 26 to 28. This should be a model for every parent in terms of attitude toward children. We often refer to Matthew 9, 36 to 38. "Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send out laborers into the harvest, into the field." And I really believe that for Christians this has got to begin at home. And whatever God wants to do with your children, whether he wants them to be engineers or mechanics or pilots or lab technicians or whatever, in whatever country, in whatever culture, I really believe that a basic prayer should be to pray that God would take your child and use him to the fullest extent and apply that prayer in that situation. I'll never forget that as I used to go to high school, almost every morning I would leave my mother sitting on a little ottoman, a little footstool in front of the fireplace with her Bible across her knees, praying for me. And I don't know what all she's praying, but I know she had a lot of things to pray for, but I know that one of the things she was praying for is that God would use me. And when people say, "Well, When did you feel called of the Lord, or what message did you get, or how did you know you're supposed to be doing what you're doing? I honestly can't point back to any Damascus Road experience. And I really believe, I just always head in this direction. And I really believe that, as I look back on it, that this ties into the fact that you were just praying for me from before I was born all the way through. And that's why it goes through in that direction. So consider that as a little sermon. You told me you didn't mind if I preached every once in a while. And then in chapter 2, this great prayer of Hannah's again. And chapter 2, verse 12, the sons of Eli were sons of Belial. What a... You know, Belial, that's speaking of Satan as personified in Baal. So what he's really saying is they're sons of the priest, but really, they're physical sons of the priest, but spiritually, they're sons of Satan. That's a pretty bad combination. And throughout that chapter, you see the evil things they did. They had immoral relationships with the women who came to worship and so on. It was a terrible thing. But listen, it's even worse for Eli, because in verse 23, we find this person that says, "Why do you do you these things? For I fear," Eli says to his sons, "Why do you these things? For I hear of your evil dealings by all this people. Nay, my sons, it's no good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people to transgress." Verse 25, "If a man sin against the Lord, who shall entreat for him? Notwithstanding, they hearken not because to the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them." Contrast. Like Ruth was a contrast to the days of the judges, so Samuel was a contrast. The child Samuel grew on and was in favor with the Lord and also with men. Sounds a lot like Luke 2:52, doesn't it? He grew in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. And there came a man of God unto Eli. See, Eli wasn't really taking his stand with his sons. And so God sends a man to speak to him. He says, "Eli, you've got a problem." This was confrontation counseling. In verse 29, "You honor your sons above me." You honor your sons above me. If you want to blast a family, if you want to ensure problems for your children, honor them and their wishes and their desires and their value system more than you honor the Lord's. I know the implementation of this is not easy, but not to implement it is a lot more difficult, as many find out. At the end of verse 39 is the principle, "For them that honor me I will honor, and them that despise me shall be lightly esteemed." And he says in verse 34 that these sons are going to die, and that he will die too. In verse 35, "I'll raise up a faithful priest." In chapter 3, we find, of course, the call of Samuel. You're very familiar with that. Three times in the night, the voice comes, and little Samuel jumps up and says, "What did you want?" And Eli says, "I didn't call you." Finally, Eli gets the message that somebody else is talking. And the message is a call to Samuel. And Samuel wants to know. Eli wants to know. He says, "What did the Lord say to you?" He said, "Well, I'll tell you what he said." And it's a hard message. And he took it. And so Samuel grew in verse 19. The Lord was with him. Verse 20, "All Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of the Lord." Now that's significant, because here's one person who's known to be a prophet of the Lord, known from Dan to Beersheba. Where is Dan at this time now? Way up by Mount Hermon. So you got, geography helps, you know. Beersheba, as far down as you can get. So we'd say from New York to San Francisco, from New York to Los Angeles, everybody knew. That is at least a start towards some kind of national identity and communication. At least everybody knew there was one man that God had his hand on. Chapter 4 is one of those really dark chapters. Israel goes out to fight the Philistines. Went out against the Philistines to battle. This is like a broken record. They're forever doing this. And they pitched their tent up by Aphek. Let me refer you to your maps again. I've got a map for this. It's a little bit later on. You'll find this on 1 and 2 Samuel, page 15. 1 and 2 Samuel, notes, page 15. Now, this traces all the movements of the ark, but right now we're interested in the first two-thirds of this. Y'all have 15? Top right-hand corner there. See that map? Movements of the ark. Thought it might be helpful. Where does the ark start from? Shiloh. This is where they went up to worship, at Shiloh. Okay, this is a pretty large-scale map. See, 4 miles is only a half an inch there. So they say, listen, if we're going to beat these Philistines, and they've got these gods with them, then why don't we take our god with us? Hey, guys, go get the ark. Let's take the ark into battle. This is the most ridiculous, blasphemous thing you could think of. Just think of the background of the ark and the Shekinah glory and the presence of God and the high priest going in once a year and all that. You're going to ask me if they had a tent over it or a shield. I don't know. They're dumb enough to do this. So they took the ark over to Ebenezer, over to Aphek. Now the dotted line shows the border of the Philistines. So they had come up to Aphek, and this is the battle at Aphek that they're talking about. Now, the Ebenezer, you're thinking of, this is the place where God helped us and so on. That's true, but not yet. That's the place, but the big event hasn't happened. This is bad news at this moment. And the Philistines come over, and they're ready to fight them. And they bring, this was a backlash. They bring the ark in. The Philistine says, we're done for. Let's run for home, guys. They brought their god with them. We've had it. This is the God that got them out of Egypt. This is the God that made Jericho fall. Listen, let's run while we can. And the Israelites, when they saw the ark come, you know, they were so happy. They shouted and so on. And finally, the Philistines said, listen, we're done for. We're going to die. We might as well die heroes. Let's go fight them. And so they went and fought them, and they defeated them. So it had a reverse effect because it scared them so much that they threw themselves into the battle, and the Philistines won. And they took, in verse 10, the Philistines fought, Israel was smitten, every man fled to his tent, big slaughter. Verse 11, the ark was taken. What do we do with the ark? We got their god with it. So they take the ark down to Ashdod. And what do we do with it? Well, let's put it in with Dagon. You know, we got a little temple there for our god. So they put it in, Dagon's the fish god. He's standing up there, sort of a statue, and this is one of the funniest parts of the Old Testament, you know? Do you read this? Isn't that great? Next morning, they come out and find Dagon down flat in his face. I think God has a sense of humor here. Say, hey, this isn't God. He's good. This box is going to knock down all our gods. What are we going to do about this? And so, it's really comical. Each of these cities takes it to the next city and said, look, we don't want to be selfish about this. We think that we ought to share this God with you. Every place they went, they got tumors or something. And when they sent the ark back, eventually they sent them with carved mice. And from that, some commentators have thought that God sent the plague on them. It was carried by mice or rats, and they recognized it. I don't know whether that's true or not. But it had a rough time, and it moved from city to city. And every place it went, they got sick. And finally, they put it on a wagon and send it back. But they bring back the ark in chapter 6. They don't know what to do with it. They eventually put it up at a place called Kiriath-Jearim. And in chapter 7, we need a revival. And by the Lord's grace, we have a revival. And in chapter 7, Samuel moves out and preaches to them and says, in effect, repent. You've gone as low as you can. If you're ever going to get out of this mess, you've got to get back to God. And they had a revival service in chapter 7, and after that, things started to go pretty well.